KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Welcome to Native America Calling. I'm Sean Spruce. Doctor visits, bill processing, cancer research, and adequate vaccination access for kids are all services that healthcare advocates say could be diminished by cuts to the federal health department. As much as a quarter of Health and Human Services employees have lost their jobs, that number could go higher. Meanwhile, cuts to Medicare and Medicaid are in the works. HHS Secretary Robert Kennedy Jr. says it's all designed to make government services more efficient and better serve the American public. We'll take a look at how those cuts impact Native Americans right after the news.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Navajo Nation President Boone Igren is supporting President Trump's orders to boost the coal industry. Trump held a signing ceremony Tuesday in Washington, D.C., where Igren was in attendance. In a statement, Igren said he wants to emphasize the importance of including tribal nations like the Navajo Nation in this national conversation. The orders are aimed at reversing policies that have transitioned the country away from coal production. The Seletz News in Oregon reports that longtime tribal chair Dolores Pigsley was recently honored by the Indian Gaming Association at the 29th annual National Indian Women Supporting Each Other Luncheon in Washington, D.C. Pigsley was recognized for her nearly four decades of serving as chairwoman of the Confederated Tribes of Seletz Indians. In those years, she helped her tribe get federally reinstated. And more recently, she helped her people get their rights to harvest, fish, and hunt on their traditional lands again after 45 years. In a recent interview, Pigsley shared her happiness at negating the consent decree.
It is probably one of the most, since I've been on a tribal council, after restoration, I was on when the tribe was restored in 77. And the next one was when we built our casino and got the land in trust in Lincoln City. And this one is right up there with those.
The youngest of eight children, Pigsley credits her success with having strong mentors and friends, including others on the Seletz Tribal Council. The 8th annual Traditional Games was held in Juneau, Alaska over the weekend. More than 250 athletes from 30 teams across the state, the lower 48, and Canada competed in a dozen different events rooted in Alaska Native values. KTOO's Clarice Larson was there and has this report.
18-year-old Matthew Chugluk of Anchorage sits low on the gym floor at Juneau Douglas High School Yada'akathle Saturday morning. His neck is craned upward and his eyes are laser-focused on a ball hanging on a string above him. Then, in one fluid motion, he kicks a leg up to touch the ball while bouncing on one hand, successfully completing an Alaskan high kick.
By showing grace in your events is by showing respect for not only the event, but yourself too.
Chugluk is Yupik, and he's one of more than 250 athletes who came to Juneau to compete in the 8th annual Traditional Games. Many of them are Indigenous, but the games are open to participants from any background. The event opened with a cultural dance and song. Throughout the three-day event, the athletes from about 30 different teams competed in a dozen different games. They're all rooted in Indigenous hunting and survival skills.
The history goes back hundreds, maybe thousands of years, so let's see it continue hundreds or thousands of more years.
That's Kyle Worrell. He's a coach and leads the program in Juneau.
It's a way to celebrate our culture and carry on these games and introduce them to youth throughout the Southeast region and beyond.
Nathan Blake is a high school senior in Juneau. Not only did he compete, but he was also in charge of getting the crowd of family, friends, and spectators excited. He says the inclusiveness of the games is one of the biggest reasons he's drawn to them.
This isn't just a game for one culture and one only. This is a game for everyone to come together and just be one with one another, regardless of how you look or what you do.
This year, athletes broke 12 records in different categories and age groups.
That was Clarice Larson, and I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support for journalism that raises the awareness of child well-being to citizens and to policymakers provided by the Annie E. Casey Foundation, building a brighter future for children, families, and communities. Information at aecf.org.
Support by Sanofsky Chambers Law, championing tribal sovereignty and Native American rights since 1976, from opioids litigation to treaty rights to tribal self-governance, with offices in Washington, D.C., New Mexico, California, and Alaska. Sanofsky Chambers Law.
Support by Siri, with a diverse and strategic investment portfolio for the long-term benefit of their shareholders. Investing in energy, infrastructure, real estate, government services, and more. Information is available at CIRI.com.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
Live from day three of the Tribal Self-Governance Conference on the lands of the Gila River Indian Community in Arizona, this is Native America Calling. I'm your host, Sean Spruce. With Robert Kennedy Jr. at the helm, the Trump administration is working fast to remake the federal health care system. That includes significantly trimming staff and costs that go into services delivered through the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. Those include medical care through the Indian Health Service. It also includes a proposed overhaul of Medicaid, an important funding source for Native health care. Today we'll get the latest look at what changes are on the table and how tribal health care advocates are preparing. As always, listeners are welcome to join the conversation. You can call in today at 1-800-996-2848. That's also 1-800-99-NATIVE. You can also engage with us through social media. We have Facebook, Instagram, Blue Sky, and Threads. Shout out or go to our website, NativeAmericaCalling.com. Let's now meet today's guests. I have three people who are joining me in one of the conference rooms at the Wild Horse Pass and Casino. We have first A.C. Locklear. He is the CEO of the National Indian Health Board. He's based in Washington, D.C. He is Lumbee. A.C., good morning and welcome to Native America Calling.
Good morning.
Also joining us is Kristen Bitsui. She is the Tribal Healthcare Outreach and Education Policy Manager for the National Indian Health Board. She's based in Tucson, Arizona. She is Navajo. Kristen, you've been on the show before. Welcome back to NAC.
Thank you so much.
Lastly, joining us is Kim Russell. She is a policy advisor for Sage Memorial Hospital, located on the Navajo Nation in Ganado, Arizona. She is also Navajo. Kim, good morning. Welcome to the show.
Good morning, Sean.
It's a pleasure to have all of you with us today. And AC, I want to begin with you. Your organization, the National Indian Health Board, has advocated for tribal consultation with the Department of Health and Human Services during this restructuring. What's been the result so far?
So far we have not really heard from the administration on how they're planning on moving forward, but we do believe that our calls for consultation have been heard. It is really imperative so we truly understand what impacts these changes have on Indian health and the programs that tribes depend on across HHS. So we look forward to working through that process. We're trying to work with the agency to find out opportunities for tribes to engage.
All right, so what I'm hearing here perhaps is a bit of a breakdown in communication. What needs to happen to get a better rapport going with the administration?
I think it's very early on. I think what our hopes were that the consultation would be the first thing the administration would do in deciding to make this kind of a step. Tribal nations agree that there's efficiencies would benefit our programs across the board. But we need to be part of that conversation. And I think the breakdown is just understanding when tribes need to be consulted in that process. With every new administration, there is this education period. And we have to continue to educate our federal government, also our congressional members as well, about the rights and the trust responsibility to tribes. And that's a consistent thing, no matter what administration, there's always that learning curve. And NIHB continues to reach out and continue to work with them and to provide support and any resources that they need to make sure that that happens. So we hope that through our advocacy, through tribal leaders' calls across the board, that we're able to kind of get ahead of that and really, you know, hopefully mitigate any harm that may have come from some of these changes.
Now, also in the news, HHS has given the option to some employees to be reassigned to IHS facilities in selected places, Alaska, Montana, and New Mexico. Is that feasible?
I'm sure it is potentially feasible. I think it's there's a lot of things in consideration there. I think first thing, again, I will go back to, is that something that the tribes need or want for their facilities? If it's not a need for those facilities, if it's not a need for what Indian Health Service has, then it's kind of a moot point. You know, we want to make sure that also that the funding is there. So if tribes do need some of these individuals and those individuals are willing to go to areas to uproot their lives to meet that need, we want to make sure that the funding is there for our already drastically underfunded system, because many of those individuals that we talk about are highly paid and highly compensated individuals who may have been clinicians before but may be in managerial positions now. So it really is a lot of different factors to go into those decisions. But ultimately, at the beginning and the end and at the middle, it's all about what the tribes need and having that conversation with them.
What other concerns are you hearing from tribal leaders right now regarding healthcare needs?
So there are many concerns. I think the reorganization is a big concern. I think the cutting of a lot of the key personnel that are effectuating a lot of these programs across HHS is a big concern. You know, we've heard of staff with the CDC's Health Free Tribe program have been let go. We've heard the Office of Assistant Secretary of Health Center for Innovation and Health Equity, for Indigenous Innovation and Health Equity, SAMHSA's, many of those programs that go to helping address mental and behavioral health, substance use disorders. While those programs haven't necessarily been cut, there's no one there to work with tribes to provide that assistance. They don't know where in the organization that these programs may be situated. They don't know how they may continue in the future. And without consultation, tribes won't have a say in that, and that's a very critical piece. So that's something we've heard a lot. But also, you know, just in general, there's been over $6 million in grants from various HHS agencies that have been cut that impact tribes. So I think tribes have spent many, many years advocating to be included in a lot of these different programs. So many instances, it may not be a tribal program. For example, CDC's environmental lead program, right? They work with tribes, states, other entities. So it's not a tribal program per se, but it's really something that tribes look to help address a lot of the issues in their communities.
AC, let's go back to this issue of tribal consultation. Of course, as everybody knows, yesterday, Robert Kennedy Jr. was here in the plenary and he was on a panel. Ideally, what should that consultation look like? What's missing and how could that be improved?
So what the consultation looks like is that before any decision is made, and when I say before, it's not once they have a policy idea that they want to propose. Tribes need to be at the beginning, middle, and end of each of these processes. So as soon as it is recognized that these changes will impact Indian country, they need to create opportunities to engage tribes directly. So, what you know, sitting across the table, engaging with the Secretary's Tribal Advisory Committee from the jump, and they can help kind of identify the best way forward to engage on a more meaningful level across Indian country, because each community has very distinct needs and engage with the agency very differently from Alaska all the way down. So it really is that they need to be across the table. There needs to be some real understanding of what these programs really do for Indian country and what the proposed changes could potentially impact. Tribes should be able to provide direct input, provide written input, and as they make changes, they should be engaging with tribes in each part of the way so that, you know, tribes can understand and, you know, really mm-hmm. provide that input.
Now, Secretary Kennedy is championing chronic disease prevention. I have to ask, how effective do you think chronic disease prevention will be amid cuts to programs like diabetes research?
Yeah, it's going to really come down to how they decide to reorganize the agency. They're looking, and they're looking at how to cut duplication. They're looking at how to bring a lot of things under one agency. So we really don't have an answer about how that will potentially look without consultation, right? But we are extremely hopeful, because chronic disease prevention is something that we really need in Indian country. We look at the success of the special diabetes program for Indians and other programs. That investment in our communities and really preventing those chronic diseases are important. So we hope that we are able to engage in a more meaningful way so that we can identify what the needs actually are and how tribes can be involved in that.
Another hot topic, funding for IHS through Medicaid. What's the latest on that?
So it still remains to be funded. We are still looking to, we're looking very closely at what Congress is going to be doing soon with the reconciliation, and what role that they are going to be doing in changing and reforming Medicare in any way. We continue to work closely with them to talk about, to share about how Medicare and Medicaid are used to supplement an already stressed system, Indian health system, and supplement the funding for it. And we want to make sure that any reform changes don't impact that funding to Indian health. So we're just working really closely with those on the Hill, trying to make sure that we're understanding more about what changes may come, to make sure that tribes are exempt from those changes.
We have A.C. Locklear kicking off our conversation on Native America Calling today. We are live at the Tribal Self-Governance Conference, Chandler, Arizona, tribal lands of the Gila River Indian community. We have the phone lines open for folks who would like to join the conversation. All you have to do is pick up that phone, give us a call, 1-800-99-NATIVE. That'll connect you with our producers in our studio in Albuquerque, New Mexico, and your call will be relayed to us here in Chandler, Arizona, and we'll get your comments on the air. You can give us a shout out, you can share a question, you can share an insight. Maybe you are a healthcare provider, maybe you work in a tribal healthcare facility and you're concerned with how some of these issues might affect services going forward, or maybe you are a patient or you're someone who receives healthcare through an IHS funded facility. Maybe you live in a city and you rely on Medicaid services. Either way, we'd like to hear from you today here on Native America Calling. So please engage with us. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we're going to hear from Kristen Bitsui, who is a tribal healthcare outreach and education policy manager for the National Indian Health Board. And in the wings, we have Kim Russell, who is a policy advisor for Sage Memorial Hospital. So stay with us. We'll be right back, folks.
Many tribes are walking a delicate balance when it comes to the Trump administration. Tribal officials see a need for working constructively with the White House, but some are speaking out more, who say the administration's actions threaten the health, safety, and economic security of tribal citizens. We'll get perspectives on the next Native America Calling.
My name is Tammy, and I'm a member of the Little Traverse Bay Band of Odawa Indians. Smoking gave me heart disease. I used to think of cigarette smoking as something that only affected me. Then at just 44 years old, I had to look into my mom's eyes on the way into emergency heart surgery and tell her, "Mommy, I promise I won't make you bury me." My tip is, think about the people in your life who love you. They go through the pain too, maybe even more than you do.
The people you love are worth quitting for. You can quit. For free help, call 1-800-QUIT-NOW. A message from the CDC.
Grandfather, do you remember all the things that you taught to me? A mother's love is free as the wind. When the wind it goes and leaves the trees without a soothing song, then how are we supposed to find the soothing songs again? Take your troubles to the river, son, and don't turn around, you see.
Thank you for tuning in to Native America Calling. I'm your host, Sean Spruce, live from the Tribal Self-Governance Conference in Arizona. We're talking with tribal leaders and healthcare advocates about the rapidly changing landscape when it comes to federal support for services. Are you seeing any changes in your community from cuts at the federal level? Are you optimistic that actions by the Trump administration will bring relief for taxpayers? Either way, let us know. Give us a call. Engage with us. We're at 1-800-996-2848. That's 1-800-996-2848. We've got the phone lines open. We are waiting for your call. 1-800-99-NATIVE. Let's hear now from Kristen Bitsui, Tribal Healthcare Outreach and Education Policy Manager for the National Indian Health Board. Kristen, again, thank you for joining us today. You've been on the show before, and the last time you spoke about the importance of Medicare and Medicaid. What are your latest concerns with threats to these services and programs?
Well, my concerns is just to make sure that everybody understands that Medicare, Medicaid, the Children's Health Insurance Program, as well as the Health Insurance Marketplace, are still there. You can still enroll into it. I want to make sure that they also understand that it's important to have healthcare coverage as well too. So that's the biggest thing that I want to put out there with. We don't know exactly what's going to come out. We don't know what those cuts are going to be as well too. But in the meantime, those programs are still available for them to enroll into.
All right. What about Social Security? How closely should tribal leaders be paying attention to any changes happening there?
As far as Social Security, which is outside of my purview, but with the CMS ITU trainings, which is something that I'm a part of, this is a training that we usually do for all of the IHS, the tribal, and also the urban, those that work in the facilities. And Social Security is part of the program that a lot of our presenters come in, and they provide training on that as well, too. So as far as the Social Security side, the program is also still there. There are still enrollment into each of those programs, which is also another part of Medicare as well, too. And so as far as I know, for the Social Security side, that's something that they can also still enroll into.
Okay, now we also talked about a proposal to send federal Medicaid funding to states in the form of block grants, right? So what's the likelihood of that happening, and what exactly would that mean, not only for providers, but also for patients?
As far as the block grant, that is something that is, you know, they put out there that each state is also deciding if they want to go around that side of it. We're not exactly sure exactly how that's going to impact a lot of Indian country as well, too. But at the same time, we also want to make sure that that information is out there for them to understand that if there is block grant, then that's something that we need to also look into to make sure that they're aware of some of these benefits that come with it as well, too, and how that's going to affect our Indian country.
Mm-hmm. Now, there's also concern that this could be, you know, any cuts to Medicaid because of the funding structure and the fact that the feds have 100% responsibility for reimbursing for Medicaid costs, unlike states which pay 50%. When it comes to Indian country, IHS or any type of urban tribal provider, 100% responsibility. Folks in some cases are looking back and they're thinking to themselves, well, geez, this could be potentially an erosion of that federal trust responsibility because it's written into the way that way those reimbursements are made. What's the concern there going forward with that larger scope with regard to what it could potentially mean for that trust responsibility if these cuts come through?
Well, with these cuts that come through, you know, we pretty much will take a look at each one as they are coming through. Sometimes it's a little bit different when it comes to Indian country. But as far as what you're talking about with the 100% FMAP, that is something that we will definitely make sure that we fight for and continue that for our beneficiaries in Medicaid as well, too. But at the same time, we also want to make sure that our tribal citizens are aware of all the things that are coming to them and how it's going to benefit them. And that's pretty much part of my job as outreach and education is that are not only are the staff that are in the ITU facilities and as well as the tribal citizens are aware of some of those changes that are going to come down the wire as well too. And I know that AC is also working on some of that on his side as well too.
All right. AC, I want to ask you, what's your thought with regard to how this could potentially impact the trust responsibility?
Yeah, for sure. And so these block grants, they would essentially shift a lot of the costs and shift a lot of the responsibility to the states, right? Mm-hmm. And The trust responsibility that tribes hold is with the federal government, not with the states. So we just want to make sure that tribes will be exempt from that, because it shifts that responsibility to an entity that they do not have a relationship with. Right. We have some tribes who have great relationships with their states. We have some tribes who don't. And that is very different across the board. And at the end of the day, the trust responsibility, the reliance on Medicare and Medicaid to help supplement a lot of that Indian health funding is based in the trust responsibility. It's based in the responsibility the federal government has. So absent the federal government providing full mandatory funding for Indian health, this program and Medicare and Medicaid needs to be, that 100% FMAP needs to be protected so that tribes can get that reimbursement, so beneficiaries can get that reimbursement.
Okay. Also, Kristen, the block grants, one of the issues with block grants is there is a ceiling there with regard to why those budgets can go. Can you talk about that and just what the impacts of that mean, what that means really to providers and again, patients?
And again, I really don't know exactly how this is going to come down the wire. There's so many different avenues that they could do. But as far as for our tribes and our tribal citizens being on Medicaid, if they were to go through the block grant, that is something that maybe work requirements, you know, something that we also have to be aware of in that way. But we also have to also educate the administration about, you know, the rural side where there's hardly any jobs there if they decide to go that route. So we're constantly looking at every little thing that's coming down so that we can understand exactly what we need to give out to the tribal communities.
One thing that's always really made me, it's complex, it's fascinating, Medicaid, it's very advanced policy. It can be very difficult to understand. And one thing I think I've learned is a lot of people, patients don't always realize that they're on Medicaid. You know, each state brands their Medicaid program in their own way. I know in Alaska, it's called Denali Care. In Oklahoma, it's called Sooner Care. In New Mexico, the latest iteration of Medicaid is called Turquoise. And it's a very, very complex web of policies. How do you work with communities so folks really understand how to access Medicaid and how these programs are structured? Again, because each one is different in every state.
Absolutely. We have 50 states, so we're looking at each one of them. And each state also does differently for the tribal communities as well, too. So on my end, I help out with the CMS ITU trainings. And those trainings are specifically for the staff of the ITU. And anytime I get notification or any changes within health policies, specifically to Medicaid, I will be able to disperse that out to them so that, because they're the ones that are, or the patient benefit coordinators are the ones that helped our tribal citizens. Majority of the time, our tribal citizens, like you said, it's very complex and it can be extremely challenging to even complete an application. And so educating these benefit coordinators is one of the key things that I always make sure that they're aware of every updated policy that's coming through that they need to be aware of.
And also, with so much of this based on speculation right now, how do you weed out the difference between what could possibly happen and what is happening? And how do you explain that to the people you work with so they're getting on time accurate information?
Absolutely. So I do get daily calls every day asking about, you know, is this true? Whether they hear it on the radio, they see it on TV, they see it on social media, whatever they're seeing, they'll, you know, contact me and ask me if that's something that they need to be aware of within their community as well, too. And as we discussed it, every state is a little bit different. So the policy that changes might be different and also on the state level as well, too. They might interpret it in a different way, or they might bring other policies to help that whatever's coming down from the top as well, too. So, but yeah, you're right. It can be very complex, but one of the ways that I'm able to keep our benefit coordinators and those that work in the facilities is through these trainings of the CMS ITU trainings.
All right. Kristen, thank you. I want to bring Kim Russell into the conversation. She's a policy advisor for Sage Memorial Hospital in Ganado, Arizona. I think it's really important that we talk to folks who are working also at the community level and implementing services. And Kim, I see you have many of your colleagues present here today in the room supporting you. And so let's talk more about Sage Memorial Hospital. How would that hospital be affected by these potential cuts to Medicare and Medicaid possibly?
Right. So Sean, I want to start off with how important Medicaid is to our hospital and really for a lot of tribal communities. You know, when we look at our payer mix and how we have third-party reimbursement, upwards of 60% is going to be our reimbursement through Medicaid. Mm-hmm. And this is unheard of for a lot of other facilities in Indian country. I've heard of even 70, 80%. So you better believe whenever there is a policy change in Medicaid, even the small policy change, all the way up to these huge policy changes that we're talking about now, which are very not definite yet, there's going to be some significant change. So whether it's a good policy that benefits tribes or a policy that's going to take things away, it's going to impact us in some way. So just wanted to start off in terms of how reliant our system is on Medicaid, and really due to the fact that a lot of our people are unemployed. They don't have that payer, that insurance through an employer. So we are heavily reliant on it. So policy changes in Medicaid is something that we should be a part of when those discussions are happening. I think going back to AC's comment about having tribes engage in that process, and specifically our hospital systems, because that's where we really have those, our community members enroll in health insurance, and we reap the benefits of that third-party reimbursement. So Medicaid is a huge program for us. And so whenever we're talking about these different policy changes, like the block grant concept or the work requirements or anything that's being proposed, you know, it has been proposed in the past. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we've heard about these policy changes. But I think just now coming into this new admission, it's just a lot of uncertainty. What's going to happen? You know, Kristen talked about how that uncertainty is with the community. Our uncertainty is as a healthcare system. What's going to happen in that regard? And so we're trying to be more proactive than reactive to these policy changes. And so being that these policy changes are not something we haven't heard of before, we're trying to be more proactive and figuring out, okay, if scenario A happens, what does that mean for us, you know, in a financial aspect or a community aspect? Or if scenario A and B happens, what does that mean for us?
Well, let's talk through that. Let's 60%, you're 60% reliant on Medicaid for the services provided at Sage Memorial. If that goes away, or if that's even significantly reduced, what happens?
I think we're, again, you know, the uncertainty, we're trying to figure what does that look like? Are they going to take away populations that are eligible, meaning that certain people will no longer be eligible for Medicaid? Or are they going to start taking away benefits, meaning then we have to possibly reduce those services? So I think that's where we have to figure out what does that look like, and then how do we respond to that? And each tribe is going to be different. One way that we responded here in Arizona when we were in a recession, and it really takes a collective of tribes to address these issues, we were able to put in place an uncompensated care waiver when benefits were taken away when we went through the recession. So I think I want to speak to the importance of tribes coming together to talk through these policy issues and these policy changes, and what are some of those possible solutions. And again, you know, AC mentioned that some of the tribes in the different states have different relationships with their state government and their state Medicaid program. Fortunately, here in Arizona, we have a decent relationship with our Medicaid program, so we were able to put through and get an uncompensated care waiver passed so that those benefits that were taken away during the recession here in Arizona, we were still able to be reimbursed for those benefits. So I think for on a national level, how do we share some of those best practices, administrative policy changes and solutions? So I think we're going to have to figure out what we do and how do we respond, not only as a tribe and a tribal community, but also as healthcare systems. How do we respond to that? And it goes back to, we just don't know what's going to happen. But until then, we're trying to gather the data We're trying to research things. We're talking to other tribes. How do we be more proactive to these changes?
We do a lot of shows with regard to these changes there at the federal level, these cuts, layoffs, and we hear that so often. Well, we don't know yet. We're just not quite sure. I'd like for anybody to respond. When do you think we'll know? When do you think we'll really be able to say, okay, this is what's really happening and this is what we're going to have to do? Anybody have any thoughts as to when? What's the timeline here?
I think that's a great question, and it's really still up in the air. I don't think based on what we're hearing, it will be in this fiscal year, but maybe in the next fiscal year if there are changes. But I think if we look at our systems, and we're at the self-governance conference, and what we've been able to do as nations in our health systems to provide additional benefits, additional levels of care for our people, all of that comes from the revenue from this third-party reimbursement from Medicare and Medicaid. The ability to provide traditional healing in our facilities, the ability to provide public health services in addition to the direct care, all of that typically comes from the revenue that these facilities are making from third party. And just on a base level, if we're not collecting, or if we are losing beneficiaries' eligibility in Medicare and Medicaid, then IHS takes that burden. So that's money that's then coming from the money that these facilities either receive from IHS or the care that they get. So IHS ends up, who is already a struggling system, taking the brunt of that. So it really will decrease the level of care across the board that our citizens get.
All right. Now, we're going to take a short break here in another minute, and we're going to talk more with you, Kim, about the traditional healing aspect and a bill that you've been pushing for here in Arizona. AC, I want to take a moment to congratulate you. You were recently named the permanent CEO of NIHB. Let's give him a round of applause.
Thank you. thanks so much.
So tell us, I think it's only been less than a week, but yeah. What's your vision in terms of the direction for the organization going forward?
NIHB was founded by the tribes over 50 years ago to really advance tribal health policy across the board and to really be their champion to increase health outcomes and tribes' ability to collect for third-party revenue and to provide for their people. So we really want to, our vision is to really build upon that and to really champion a lot of things that we've been really fighting for over the last few years, especially around traditional healing and other things like that, but also increase our ability to provide services to tribes to build their capacity for public health. As we all saw through COVID, as we're seeing now, our public health infrastructure in Indian country is critical. So we're hoping that we can advance a lot of those priorities.
All right, AC, I know you've got to run. You've got another panel to present on. So I want to thank you for taking the time to join us.
Thanks,
we're going to take that short break. When we come back, we're going to continue our conversation with Kim Russell and Kristen Bitsui. And the phone lines are open for anyone who would like to join the conversation. 1-800-99-NATIVE. What are you waiting for? Give us a call. Let's talk some healthcare policy.
Challenges to societal harmony abound. Trauma, depression, addiction. In Native communities, these challenges affect nearly everyone. The Native American Social Work Studies Institute educates social workers for careers to address the needs of Native communities. You can be part of the solution as a peer support worker, community health worker, or a counselor with culturally relevant training from the Native American Social Work Studies Institute. Info at online.nmhu.edu. New Mexico Highlands University supports this show. This program is supported by AmeriCorps Vista. Through service with AmeriCorps Vista, you gain valuable professional experience and leadership skills while helping organizations in your community alleviate poverty. Find a service opportunity at AmeriCorps.gov/Vista today. That's AmeriCorps.gov/Vista. Are you or someone you care about looking to take their education to the next level? Native Forward Scholars Fund is here to help. With awards up to $30,000, Native Forward Scholars Fund is dedicated to supporting Native students as they pursue higher education. With Native Forward Scholarships, you can overcome financial barriers and open doors to a world of opportunities. Native Forward Scholars Fund, working to build a brighter future and empower Native students one scholarship at a time. Info and applications at nativeforward.org, who support this show. Support by Alaska Growth Capital.
The Bristol Bay Marketplace is now open. Bristol Bay Native Corporation shareholders, descendants, and spouses are eligible. Applications are available at alaskagrowth.com under Marketplace. Skugtash. For more than 40 years, Ramona Farms has revived ancient traditional foods, tepary beans, pinoli, polentas, and more, all from store.ramonafarms.com. Ramona Farms supports this show. Omnye.
We're glad you're along with us on Native America Calling today. I'm your host, Sean Spruce, and there's still plenty of time for anyone who would like to join today's conversation. You can call in with questions and comments about healthcare and other services and how they're changing. The number is 1-800-996-2848. That's 1-800-996-2848. I'm joined right now by Kristen Bitsui, who is the Tribal Healthcare Outreach and Education Policy Manager for the National Indian Health Board, and also Kim Russell, Policy Advisor for Sage Memorial Hospital. And Kim, let's talk more about Sage Memorial Hospital. It is a critical access hospital. It's a rural hospital. Explain for our listeners how it's different than perhaps a large university hospital. I'm thinking of like the University of New Mexico Hospital there in Albuquerque.
Right. We just had this conversation this morning about the differences between the hospitals, at least in our state. And you know, we are a rural hospital. So when I say rural, we are rural. There is no gas station in Ganado. You know, you got to go a couple miles down the road there. No hotels. So we are very rural, but a very close-knit kind of community. So I think the differences that I see coming to work with Sage Memorial Hospital is that we're more community focused, as opposed to maybe some of the bigger hospitals that are in the city and maybe, you know, connected to other resources, you know, specifically universities. I see our hospital really being having to respond to more community needs. So when we talk about social determinants of health, I think that's where we were very prevalent in, and that's where we concentrate a lot of our efforts in. Because we see our community, and it's not like we can have them go down the road and help them with a food bank. You know, we don't have that in the rural part of our reservation. Or we can refer them to a bus line so they can get back home. We don't have those things in our rural community, and so we're having to address those social determinants of health. You know, we're trying to figure, could we have a food bank in our community so that we can address food insecurity. We're thinking about putting up a hostel because after our patients come back from treatment, sometimes off reservation, they need a place to stay before they can go back home in a safe environment. So I think that's the difference I see with our small rural hospital, is that we're really having to also address social determinants of health for our communities. I think also in addition, and I don't know that this wouldn't be something for the more urban rural hospital systems, but we also have to consider like housing for our providers. So that's, you know, how can we build our services if we can't house our providers? Mm-hmm. So we focus on different things as compared to a bigger hospital system that might be in the city. Maybe their aim might be more research oriented. So we're different. They're both hospital systems that do the work that they need to do in our community, but you're right, Sean, we are different in how we focus our efforts and where we place our resources.
Now, the topic of traditional healing was mentioned before the last break. You've been pushing for a traditional healing bill here in the state of Arizona. Tell us more about that.
Sure. So I just want to say I'm really happy that after almost a decade, years of work that the tribes here in Arizona had to put in, that we are finally at a point where we have CMS approval for this waiver to move forward. So I do want to say, you know, this did not happen overnight. We had tribes across the state come together to figure out what does that look like within the waiver process. And really fortunate that our state Medicaid program was willing to come to the table to talk to us about what that could look like, right? So 10 years in the making, it went through a few administrations, and finally the prior administration approved the waiver. So we're really happy that happened. Also want to mention that, you know, we're trailblazers in this sense of traditional healing and having it reimbursed through the IHS and tribal facilities, because other states saw what we were doing, and happy to also report that there's three other states who submitted similar waivers, right? And it's approved as well. So not only are the tribes in Arizona going to benefit from the traditional healing waiver. We have other states, I think we have New Mexico, California, and Oregon who has a approved traditional healing waiver. So after those 10 years, our next step is to make sure that we have the appropriations to implement the waiver.
And for our listeners who might not be familiar, and again, when we talk about traditional healing, that could mean something very different on the Navajo reservation as compared to what it might mean in one of the Pueblos, or maybe in South Dakota or in Alaska. Tell us more about how traditional healing is implemented there at Sage Memorial, and also these potential cuts to Medicaid, how it could impact the ability to perform those services.
Okay. Well, at Sage Memorial, we do have a traditional healing program. It's based within our behavioral health program, so there's an obvious connection to our behavioral health program. It's a new program, and we're getting that started up. We're trying to build a hogan, right, on our campus. We've not had a hogan built there in a bit because that's where we heal, you know, as Navajo people, is in our hogan. So we have that program up and running, and we're really happy to figure how does then the traditional healing waiver support that. A lot of our IHS and tribal facilities have had traditional healing programs even before the waiver, right? Because we recognized the need for it and that it was an obvious way for us to heal and be better people. That's the mission of the Indian Health Service, and the mission of a lot of our tribal health systems is what programs do we put in place that help people become healthier, you know, people. And so it made sense for us to do the traditional healing program. So we do have that within our hospital system. And like I mentioned, a lot of other hospitals already had that. Now we're just trying to figure how do we implement the waiver and with the appropriations that we need for that. So when we talk about cuts to Medicaid, again, this waiver is a Medicaid waiver. And so how should those cuts happen? What does that mean for then our Medicaid waiver? Should we get it passed into law, the appropriations for that? Again, uncertainty, right? How does that happen? How do we protect that waiver? Some questions we're talking about is, could the administration rescind, you know, the waiver? What is happening in that regard? So when we talk about policy changes, we're looking at not only legislative policy, but also administrative policy. And where do we have opportunities to support and I think really protect some of these advances we've made, especially with our traditional healing waiver?
Well, let's go to the phones. We have a caller on the line right now. This is Ty, who is listening in Phoenix, Arizona on Spotify Podcast Live. Ty, hello. You are on the air. What's your comment?
Hi, Yat E, and I'm from Chanyavo. My name is Ty. My question is for Chris. What are the benefits to Medicaid, and how do you apply for Medicaid? I have another question for Kim. I currently have ACCESS, which is the Arizona Healthcare Cost Containment System of Medicaid. And I was wondering if there was a list of eligible traditional healing services for reimbursement, and do you know what those are?
Ooh, good question, Ty. Kim?
Okay. So, Ty, like I mentioned, we're still in the process of getting this implemented. At the CMS level, federal level, it was approved, which then allows the state to implement it. So we're still in that implementation stage. And part of that implementation stage is for us to get our Senate bill across the line and passed into law this session. Really, it's a budget appropriation. So we're not quite at the point where traditional healing is reimbursed. But I do want to say, depending on where you live, like I mentioned earlier, some of our IHS and tribal facilities and even urban programs already provide traditional healing. So depending on where you live and which urban program or tribal program or IHS program you access, they will have their own type of traditional healing program specific to their population. So I think, Ty, it depends on really kind of where you live and which IHS tribal or urban program that you access. And then from there, you'll learn more about what traditional healing services they provide for their community.
All right. Thank you for that call, Ty. And Kristen, I want to go back to you for a national perspective because you're working with hospitals and healthcare providers across Indian country. And what are you hearing from folks in other states with regard to traditional healing practices and possibly also attempting to implement some of these services, specifically in states like California and New Mexico?
Oh, definitely. Aside from the four that Kim had shared, there are other states that are wanting to do this as well, too. Other tribes are interested. So when these four waivers were being put through, a lot of those other tribes were, you know, waiting just to see what will happen and what's going to get approved. And so each one of them are very different in different ways as well, too, each of the traditional healing waivers. But they are all very interested. So just recently from Great Plains was interested, and so we did a presentation to them just to kind of give them an idea of what the traditional healing waiver is about for all of those four states.
All right. Also, just hurdles for rural hospitals in other areas. We heard Kim talk about just having to provide, in some cases, housing for staff. What do you see in other parts of Indian country?
In the rural side of it, it could even be transportation. I have heard from individuals that are pregnant and that need to get to their appointment, and their appointment is probably like about 20, 30 miles away. And some of the states don't have transportation coverage through Medicaid, and other states do. And so just depending on where the location is at, and as you know, Kim had mentioned, some of these areas are, there are rural communities within in Indian country is so much different than the general population rural community. And what I mean by that is that some of our communities don't have running water. Some of them don't have electricity. Some of them are so far away that they have to think about either using their gasoline for water or to go get an appointment, you know, depending on what that is. So the balance there, are some different things that we have to think of in our tribal communities.
Kim, I learned earlier that Sage Memorial has 26 beds, I believe. What types of services and procedures typically are you folks able to provide there?
So we are, like mentioned, a critical access hospital. Some of the current services we provide are just general adult medicine, inpatient and outpatient. We also have swing beds, pharmacy, which is very convenient.
And a swing bed, help me out here. What exactly is a swing bed?
I think it's when people need to stay there for a certain amount of time, but doesn't really require that higher level of care. So like, let's say an example would be someone goes off and for a hip procedure off reservation, right, and they come back. But they really still need a level of care that may not necessarily be provided at home, and there is a time limitation to that.
Got it. I also want to talk about the tariffs. That's big news as well. And as consumers, as just pretty much everybody's lives are impacted. But what about there at the hospital? I'm thinking with regard to medical supplies, pharmaceuticals.
Yeah, so who's not talking about tariffs, right?
Right.
I think on an individual level, on a family level, on a community level, and of course at the healthcare system level. So, we're just kind of embracing for all the different ways that we're going to have to pay those extra costs. And of course, they're going to be what you mentioned, you know, cost of equipment and supplies will increase, the food that we have in our cafeterias and provide to our inpatients. So across the board, we just know that these tariffs are going to have an impact on our healthcare system, where costs are going to have to increase. And, you know, how do we respond to that, especially when these are looming Medicaid cuts that will then decrease our revenue.
And some of these costs are already high, right, Kristen? Like pharmaceuticals, I mean, it's already costing a lot of money to provide a lot of this health care.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, as she's talking about the medication part, the clinical side, but you also have to think about the linens as well, too, the housekeeping side. You know, all of those things play a part in being able to run a facility. And so, you know, having to think about those kind of items, taking it to the rural side where Kim is at, that could take some pretty much a lot of money to do that as well, too. So thinking about those kind of things for the rural community, tribal facilities.
Now here at the conference again, the Tribal Self-Governance Conference, some of the sessions that you've attended and the conversations, the networking, are folks dialed into these issues we're talking about today?
I think so. I've had numerous conversations since I've been here with my colleagues across the country about, you know, how are you going to respond to the different administration policies that are coming down the pike. And a lot of it, like was mentioned earlier, is we're not too sure yet, right? Mm-hmm. So I think, again, going back to being more proactive. And that's kind of the strategy that we're embracing. How can we be proactive? And so, you know, we're being charged to do the research and to gather the data so that we can at least have an idea of what the impact possibly could be. But then how do we then have plans in place, some contingency plans to respond to that? And we recognize that sometimes what we want to do may not be, we may not have the resources, right? So we're going to do our best to respond to these policy changes. And it's nothing new to Indian country when policy changes impact us. And I think that speaks to the resilience of our systems, our community, and just being engaged at all levels of federal policy, tribal policy, state policy making.
Kristen, how often do you attend conferences like this, and how effective are they in terms of engaging with tribal leaders and others about pressing healthcare issues?
You know, conferences are great. They're great for networking, great to see what's going on, not in just only your state, but other states as well, too, and other facilities. I always say that, especially on my level, when I do outreach and education, this is my bread and butter. This is where I need to know what's going on. I might not be aware of certain policies that might not be working for that certain community, but yet maybe for another community it is. But I need to know what those are. And Kim had talked about best practices. That is pretty huge. We need to keep talking. We need to keep engaging. We need to work together to really understand how these policies are going to affect our communities. If we don't do that on a national level, we might not know how to do that advocacy for you if you're not telling us what that is. And so that's where my bread and butter is at, is you guys telling me what is going on. And if you're hearing something different, or maybe there's another policy that's coming down the wire that has already been implemented that I'm not aware of, then if, you know, there's some lessons learned coming from that, I want to know about that as well.
All right. Well, unfortunately, we are out of time, so we're going to have to wrap up the conversation. Kristen, thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah.
Kim as well. And with that, all of our guests today, we had A.C. Locklear, and of course, full name, Kristen Stewie, and I'm Sean Spruce.
Program support by AmeriCorps Vista, where you can kickstart your career and help others in your community. With AmeriCorps Vista, you can serve in an office setting and address issues of poverty while gaining career experience and building your leadership skills. Learn more by visiting AmeriCorps.gov/Vista today. That's AmeriCorps.gov/Vista.
Support provided by Amerind. Amerind is 100% tribally owned and partners with tribes and their businesses to provide affordable commercial insurance coverage, protect tribal sovereignty, and strengthen Native American communities by helping to keep dollars in Indian country. Information about property, liability, commercial auto, and workers' comp available at Amerind.com. That's AmeriND.com.
Native America Calling is produced in the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico, by Kwanic Broadcast Corporation, a Native nonprofit media organization. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, with support from the Public Radio Satellite. Thank you.